Recording.
Good morning and welcome to the July 9th, 2018 meeting of the Chelan County Public Utility District. I'd like to remind everyone, probably myself as well, to please silence your cell phones and any other electronic devices that you may have with you today. Let me just make sure. Yes, okay. I don't want to be a violator. Today's meeting is a study and business session with the study session starting this morning at 10. We welcome the public input at our meetings, and since the meetings are recorded, if you wish to address any item on the agenda, we ask that you come forward to the microphone. Please state your name and address for the record. So this morning we have a quorum. We have four commissioners in attendance. Commissioner Congdon is joining us by phone. Good morning, Ann. Are you there? She has us probably muted. Commissioner Bolts is not with us this morning. All of the customary... Yes. Oh, hi, Ann. Thank you. All of the customary staff members are with us this morning. The general manager, Steve Wright, general counsel, Eric Walquist, and sitting in as clerk of the board is Teresa Boucher this morning. Thank you for joining us, Teresa.
Thank you.
We'll start a meeting today with a Pledge of Allegiance and a Safety Minute by Jeff Osborne.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good morning. Jeff Osborne. I think my title is Senior License Compliance Specialist now. So today, I'd like to provide something near and dear to my heart, boating safety, but with a little twist to it, if you will. With the salmon fisheries, we have some tremendous assets that have been created in the Chelan Falls area with our Chinook Acclimation Facility and our habitat areas for spawning and rearing that have spawned a wonderful fishery off the mouth of the Chelan River. Mm. So we're not only looking at boating safety, but also while you're out there chasing the big ones, okay? So a few recommendations to consider the next time you're out there looking for the big kings. Be weather-wise. Obviously, if things are looking like a thunderstorm or something like that is coming through, probably good to run for cover. Also, follow up a pre-trip checklist. I got this off the boating safety web page, which is a wonderful, wonderful resource. You know, check your horn, your lights on your vessel. Fire extinguishers, throwable, obviously flotation devices, very, very important, making sure that you have one for every person on board. Use common sense. Seems like an easy one to do, but if you're in a crowded area where you have a lot of fishing boats, probably not a good idea to go through full speed, go through slowly. Making sure that you're respectful of all buoys and other navigational devices. Also, have someone else on board that's kind of a designated assistant skipper, if you will, that's familiar with your vessel. So you have several folks that can operate the vessel well while you're out there. Because, again, while you're chasing the big ones around, sometimes everyone gets pretty chaotic, which is what the desire is, correct? Develop a float plan. Another thing is let people know where you're going. I mean, heaven forbid, bad things happen, but if you let other people know where you're going, that's generally the place where people will start looking for you. Another one of the common sense, avoid alcohol. The statistics here say probability of being involved in a boating accident doubles when alcohol is involved. So celebrate after you're back at the dock and you've got the big one there when you're taking pictures, okay? Another one that seems kind of commonsensical to me, too, learn to swim. I would personally be terrified to go out in a boat on the water if I didn't know how to swim. But unfortunately, it seems like that's a fairly common place occurrence. So swimming would be good if you're going out in the water. The other option, considered a free vessel check, either with the U.S. Coast Guard, actually Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, law enforcement would go through that. If you can call ahead and arrange with them, have your vessel go through. They will check all the checklists that I mentioned earlier, ensure that you have all the proper equipment on board. from a fishing perspective, very important, use barbless hooks. Again, that is a legal, you know, the resource agencies say that that's good for when you're releasing wild fish. It's also easier to get them out of your partner's flesh when you've got the excitement of trying to chase that big one around the boat. Okay, my father and I have done that to each of us on more than several occasions. And then last, but also very important, ensure that you put the boat plug in your transom before you, yes, we've all done it. We've all done it. The boat floats much better, ensures many, many more hours of fun fishing while you're out there in a safe manner. So, you know, be safe. Good fishing.
Great.
Great report.
Yeah, good report. Thanks, Jeff. Appreciate that.
And Jeff, while you're there, just a quick comment. I appreciate the swimming aspect of that. It's a good reminder because a few years ago when I was in education, we did a survey. This was just the kids up in Leavenworth. 86% of the kids in Leavenworth had never taken a swimming lesson.
Wow.
And when you look at the, we have the YMCA folks here and the great job that they're doing, and a lot of kids, particularly kids of poverty, don't get that opportunity. So when you take kids out on a boat, don't take for granted they know how to swim. Thank you.
Well, Jeff, one more thing before you leave. You had showed me a picture in the out in the hallway. I'd like you to share that with my fellow commissioners. This is a...
That's Emily Osborne on 4th of July morning.
Where's that?
It's nearly as big as
your
daughter.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's fabulous. Wow. That's why we take her. She's the good luck.
Good luck, Matt. Yeah.
Probably has still haven't got the smile off her face.
Holy cow. That's great. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you. Appreciate it. Yeah, that was great. So, commissioners, we've been presented with an agenda. Items on the consent agenda are subject to transfer to the regular agenda or upon request of any commission member. Do I hear any such request? Hearing none. Steve, I'd like to turn the meeting over to you for introduction of the agenda items.
Okay, so next up, we want to talk about the ENIAC Marina. Michelle Smith.
Wow, magical. Good morning, commissioners. I'm Michelle Smith, Director of License Compliance, and with me is Vicki Griffin, Manager of Real Estate Services and Permitting. We are here to talk about the City of ENIAC's plans to construct a marina at ENIAC. We have two parts of this that Chelan PUD is involved with. One is we have a 2011 interlocal agreement with the City of ENIAC. Let me get us to this slide. That basically is our agreement to support the location of their marina. That interlocal agreement needs to be amended and restated because the location has changed. So we want to make sure that we are giving you a briefing today to explain the location and what the City of ENIAC's plans are. And hopefully this will give you the background so that when we bring forward the amended and restated interlocal in a few weeks, you'll have the background to approve that. The second portion of the marina is that the portion of the marina will be located on submerged PUD property. If you're familiar with the area, there's an island commonly referred to as Knife Island, just north of the park and some of the private properties there. The marina is proposed to be built in that location, and the PUD owns property that's submerged between the island. We actually own the island and up to the shoreline. So portions of the piles and the floating portions of the marina docks will be located on our property, which is the second part of our discussion today, which will be giving you some background on the approvals needed for that, one of which is a FERC approval, basically because any marina within our project boundary requires FERC approval. Anything more than 10 slips requires FERC approval. We have that submittal ready to go, but we wanted to wait until the board approved our interlocal agreement before proceeding with that. The second portion is the PUD's approval will be in the form of a, it's a permit, but it's a license to basically have those structures on PUD-owned property. So those, that agreement and that license will have all of the protections and agreement items in it, and Vicki will talk more about that. So I've gone through a lot of the overview items. It's a 65-slip marina. Portion of it will be on our property. Revising the interlocal is something that we'll be bringing forward to you, hopefully by the end of this month. There will be no operational impacts to the PUD as a result of ENEAT's plans to construct the marina. And we'll be developing that license, as I mentioned, and we will be seeking FERC approval.
So good morning. I'd like to talk about the two different agreements that were part of all of this. The first one is a land exchange agreement, and this was done outside of the relicensing process. And in the agreement, we agreed to exchange 8.5 acres of land that we owned for 8.5 acres of land that ENEAT owned within the area that we managed as the park. So that allowed us to complete our park ownership and have full control over everything that we're managing in the park. And in exchange, they received 8.5 acres in different parcels. And I quickly go to this slide. So the exchange was, where'd my mouse go? Was for this piece here and this piece here, which was approximately 8.5 acres. Let's see, now I lost my place here. So this also helps with the goal that we have had all along of providing them with better ownership of the waterfront and their ability to economically improve their area and develop it. So I'm going to go back to the other one for a second. The second agreement was a lease and purchase agreement that was done as part of the Rocky Reach relicensing, the settlement agreement. And in that, we agreed to lease and then purchase or sell to ENEAT 12 acres of waterfront. And actually, that property is in between these two blue areas. So it was the waterfront in between this blue area and this blue area, all of that area. Initially, the 12 acres included all of the waterfront as well. came back and said we couldn't sell anything below our project boundary. So it ended up, we agreed to sell them 7.5 acres, which is this kind of peach-colored area. And then we granted them an easement on the waterfront area so that they could continue to develop that as long as it was within our licensing requirements. So again, the whole idea was for them to be able to develop that area and gain some economic improvement in their area.
I just wanted to add to that that during relicensing, we spent a lot of time discussing and working with ENEAT. As you may know, ENEAT was basically moved. The whole town was moved when Rocky Reach Dam was built, and so a lot of our discussion revolved around how can we bring back some of the waterfront for ENEAT to develop and regain some of their economic vitality. And so we were looking for all kinds of ways to do that, and one of the ways was obviously to give them back as much of the land and the rights so that they could construct and use the waterfront more constructively. So these agreements, whether they were done during relicensing or as part of relicensing, were all meant to try and support their efforts.
So the 2011 interlocal agreement between the district and the city of ENEAT was developed as we've said before, for economic development of the area. We initially had done the exchange and then the agreement. What had happened is we went back and looked at all of the old agreements, listened to the hearing tapes, spoke with internal people from ENEAT, the consultant they are using to develop their marina plan, and everybody that we talked to understood that the marina was to be going to go down in this proposed marine area that it says here. But in the interlocal agreement, we actually identified the marina as going on this property. So that's the reason, the biggest reason that we're coming back and asking to amend and restate that interlocal is to clarify the location of the marina so that it's it's clear for the district's records as well as ENIAP that we all know and understand where the marina is going, because we don't actually have permission from the board to give permission for them to have the marina on this location. So that's the agreement that we'll be bringing back to the board, hopefully sometime in July, maybe a little bit after that, that we'll give you a chance with a resolution and a new interlocal agreement to approve the actual location that the city of ENIAP has wanted to develop that property. The marina itself is, the application they've submitted is for a 65-slip marina that has about 13,234 square feet of overwater structure. That includes a day-use dock, overnight moorage, a fuel dock, sanitary pump station, and upland improvements that includes trails, roadway, parking, and mitigation plantings. They have a lot of development dollars and time in developing this for their area, and we just want to make sure that everything is on board with the district and that we have protections in place for ourselves as well. So part of the agreement that we'll be bringing will include a license agreement, which Michelle alluded to, that provides protection for the district. Basically, it states that the operation, maintenance, construction, any liability is at the sole expense of the city of ENIAP. It provides protection for us that we can cancel the permit if we need to do so for licensing purposes or if they aren't complying with any of the portions of the agreement. But it will be a little bit more robust, actually a lot more robust than a lot of our agreements, simply because of the magnitude of the project. Having a fuel dock and a sanitary pump station, of course, are environmental dangers, if you will, if something should happen, and we want to make sure that the district is protected in those instances.
Okay, and I'll wrap this up by just kind of stating some of the things that are next steps here. Did want to point out that the city of ENIAP has received all of their federal, state, and local permits for the marina. FERC, as I stated, must approve this, and so once we get the interlocal approved by the board, we will submit that. Their turnaround time is normally between 3 and 6 months from FERC to approve. We will then put any of the FERC requirements into the license agreement that we plan to finish up at that time. We will be issuing the license agreement is basically an agreement to occupy project lands and waters. And then we also understand, talking and discussing all of this with the city of ENIAP, that they plan to begin seeking grant funding as soon as they get the approvals in order. So we are the last check boxes for them before they can go out and start trying to seek money to actually construct the project. Any questions?
Just a comment. And Michelle, you alluded to it. No community in Chelan County has sacrificed more for the benefit of Chelan County than ENIAP has in this process with the construction of Rocky Reach Dam, moving of the entire community. So this is, I'm sure the citizens of ENIAP are excited about the potential of what's happening here, and I'm excited for them.
Michelle, I just have a question, just a clarification. Where the marina comes right down and goes to the water, is the district still owning that shoreline for high water mark?
I'll let Vicki answer that.
So we own in the blue area, we own to the line of ordinary high water, which means, and basically they're going to dredge and fill that area. So there will be a large portion of this that's actually on their property. Anything past that, the ordinary line of high water between that and Knife Island, we do own that under water. We don't own any upland area. So the license will cover both the impact on the project boundary that they own as well as protecting us on the property that they're using that we own. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. Thank you. Well, great. And any questions? She must have us on mute, so thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you.
OK,
Okay, next up, we want to continue our practice of a quarterly electric load growth update. So Chad Rissman and Andy Wendell will be joining us.
Good morning, Commissioners. Andy Wendell, Director of Customer Service.
Chad Rissman, Director of Engineering and Asset Management and Distribution.
Okay, so today we got a pretty short agenda. We're going to really talk about two topics. One is just what we're seeing active in new projects, customer projects, as well as give you an update on the June 20th agency planning meeting that was focusing on cryptocurrency zoning. There's really no action requested today. As you may recall, this slide comes from the May 14th public hearing on cryptocurrency. We indicated to the public that we would continue the county and municipal planning discussions and those efforts focused on the coordination and review of cryptocurrencies and zoning. We also indicated that we would communicate to them some of our areas in our electric distribution and transmission systems where we may have some capacity. And also, we just summarized those early indicators that cryptocurrency in the residential areas were considered unsafe by the district and challenging. Also, using growth capacity for cryptocurrency mining, limits our ability to respond to our traditional organic growth. And we wanted to consider options with the municipalities and the county on creating cryptocurrency zones. So that was just kind of setting up that expectation for the June 20th joint agency planning meeting. So we were successful in pulling about 21 members of each one of the municipalities and the county together on June 20th. We had about a four-hour discussion on cryptocurrency zoning and impacts on the electric grid. We had wide participation from every municipality, strong interest in the topic. The county was also present. There's a lot of interest among the planners on zoning and cryptocurrency. So we went in with some desired outcomes. And we shared these desired outcomes prior to the meeting, so I think these were universal across the municipalities in the county. But we really wanted to try to find ways to align on some common direction for planning. Where do we put this stuff? The zoning, the permitting processes around the cryptocurrencies in the incorporated and the municipal areas in the county. And we wanted to specifically focus on some of those planning processes. So we understand if we're citing cryptocurrencies, just what are the impacts and how do we get to yes, if you will. And the third component, we were sharing a lot of ideas and thoughts around setting ordinances, codes, and policies outside of the district policies, but specific to the municipalities and the county on safety standards and properly locating the cryptocurrencies. So those were some of the desired outcomes. And as you can imagine, we hit a lot of those. We didn't cover all of that ground, or we didn't find resolution on all of those, but we had fantastic discussions around those. Really, the meeting on June 20th with the municipalities and the county, we gave a pretty in-depth presentation on growth projections, as you've seen in previous quarterly updates, but it was really the first time the county and the municipalities have seen those really in-depth studies as far as the impact of the cryptocurrencies on our electric grid and the challenges that we have that. So that was very useful for them during those discussions. We also talked briefly about the concerns with mixed use. We use mixed use as a term to say you're living in a home and you're cryptocurrency mining. The challenges that we've experienced even up to recently as last week on continued unauthorized cryptocurrency mining in residential homes and the safety concerns that the PUD has there. There was a lot of, I would say, empathy for us on that and a lot of recognition across the board that cryptocurrency in the residential sector was not only challenging from a load perspective, but also presents a lot of unsafe acts and concerns for us. We had additional discussions, as I mentioned earlier, on cryptocurrency zoning, the preferences around that. And the discussion was kind of circling this idea about where do we zone for it? And if we do zone for it, how much and over what period of time? Again, we didn't reach final conclusion on all those, but we had very, very good discussion on those. Some of the outcomes or the meeting highlights, agency planners expressed that now they have a much deeper understanding of the electrical supply limitations, particularly associated with a widely distributed cryptocurrency customer platform. Widely distributed meaning in all areas of the county, at the ends of our feeders, not just in the industrial zones, but all of the areas, and the challenges that presents us. Agency planners, they also recognized and acknowledged that it's their role and their responsibility to update the zoning and planning and incorporate the electrical planning requirements into their growth plans, right? So in other words, they're driving the zoning and planning for the cryptocurrency locations versus the PUD determining where those have to be. Now, we did, through that discussion, share with them some of the early indicators as far as some of the zoning areas that were limited and some of the zoning areas that we think that we can accommodate some larger loads. But we haven't concluded that yet. We still have to bring that information forward to the public in general. So there's more discussion around that. And the third bullet there, the agency planners were specifically requesting more time from myself and Chad and other staff members to go to the municipalities and go to the county commissions and give that in-depth understanding of the impacts on the electric grid and the impacts of a widely distributed cryptocurrency mining customer base and the challenges that we face there. So we've got a request from them to do that, and I want to talk a little bit more about that towards the end of the presentation. Some of the specific action items that we kind of agreed on as a group, the PUD was, we were asked to perform a study, an engineering study that would look at the impacts of cryptocurrency mining in the residential sector specifically, and what challenges and impacts there would be. We've done some of that, and we recognize even with a small distribution, say a 5% utilization of cryptocurrency mixed use in residential customers, say if just 5% of our customers did that, we could see a material impact on not only system loads, peak loads, but also the local area distribution loading on cables and local transformers. So some challenges there, and I think that Chad and I are working on trying to scope out a little bit more on that engineering study, what that might look like in totality, and we could certainly bring that back as a future topic for you as well. But the bottom line is, in addition to the safety concerns, residential cryptocurrency mining could have a very material impact on our electric grid. Agency planners, another takeaway, agency planners are working towards updating their comprehensive plans and trying to identify, again, that where do we zone, how much do we zone, and over what period of time do we zone. An example of that, and kind of tagging on to the INEAT discussion, is Chad and I have had very in-depth conversations with INEAT about their waterfront development and the energy requirements for that new waterfront development and the challenges with the cryptocurrency mining and how those may offset each other. So, so that's very forefront in our conversations with municipals. The third bullet there, the planners, they believe their agencies need a much deeper understanding of the economic value of cryptocurrency mining in their communities, and if they resource those from a zoning perspective, what is that economic value? And I want to emphasize that that was an unsolicited discussion by us. It just came up through that planning period. But there was, I would say, unanimous agreement that there needs to be more discussion countywide, all the agencies, to get a better understanding of the economic values associated with cryptocurrency mining. I was not in a position to commit the district to making that determination, but certainly helping that discussion along. So just be aware that that is out there and there's a request for that. The final bullet there is the agency planners were requesting that PUD staff provide more background information specifically to the city councils and the county commissioners on all of what we've discussed today. It's essentially bring that June 20th discussion right to the city councils and right to the county commissioners again. We've done that at a much higher level several months ago. It sounds like they're requesting an additional effort there. And I did make a commitment to seeking a green light on that. So I want to talk a little bit more about that after Chad finishes giving us an update on the customer growth projects.
So in one of the first presentations, we go ahead and go to the next one, Andy. We put out this map here where we put on there what we thought was going to be the next 3 years, potentially next 3 years, where loads would go. And this is just our own internal forecast based on discussions and with developers and discussions with others. So now what we're trying to do is monitor what real applications come in and reconcile those real applications with this map. So the next slide, I've got some detailed applications that have come in the different areas just to get a sense. One of the things I want to point out, we'll look at this in the Kashmir area. We had forecasted the next 3 years to be 3.4 megawatts, included 2.4 of HDL mining. Well, a recent application that we've received is 3.4 megawatts alone in just some commercial space. So that's going to increase the amount of the amount of requests there in the Kashmir area when we reconcile this map. So in other places, you know, we're seeing things coming in. I wanted to just touch on INEAT specifically there for a minute. Andy talked about that in the previous discussion, in the previous presentation on the marina. The city of INEAT's got some really neat plans, including the marina, and anticipating a significant amount of growth in the longer run. So we've sat down with them, as Andy mentioned, which is really an outcome of us sitting down specifically with the planners. And we've made an estimate on, preliminary estimate on what we think they'll need electrically to support their long-term plans. And we think it's somewhere around 50 megawatts. Well, that just happens to be about the size of a single substation that's got two banks in it, right? So we've made previous presentations where we're in discussions with them about where would that facility be located. So I think we're kind of carving the way of what this would look like when we start to put into the comp plan. They develop their comprehensive plans in terms of what they would like to see. They're moving forward on that, and then we're taking those comp plans, understanding what we would need from an electrical infrastructure standpoint, and then we're working together to try to site those things. So the work that's being done there in cooperation with the city of INEAT, it's kind of fun and paving the way for where we're going here. But we have in here in the INEAT area only 0.1 megawatts. So in the next 3 years, so that obviously that could change. We want to make sure that we are siting, understanding where we want to put this infrastructure. We have very little capacity available in INEAT, so we have like 3 or 4 megawatts available. In INEAT, the existing substation is quite a bit smaller than our standard substation. So we probably would move that up the list, even though we're not anticipating in the next couple, 3 years that that electrical infrastructure will specifically be needed, but it gives us the capability. So we'll be bringing those requests forward. Anything else on here, Andy, that we wanted to point out?
Yeah, I would just mention that one of our early quarterly updates in January and February, we had on the total down in the lower right hand corner 220 megawatts of cryptocurrency mining, and of course we had those in applications. And although, you know, the moratorium of course is still on, we've seen a decline in that 220 megawatts as some applicants have chosen to pull their applicants out, or change them from larger to a smaller application. So I'm not in a position to be able to tell you exactly what that number is today, but we've seen a pretty steady decline in that total 220 megawatts throughout this time period. We'll try to, in our next update, maybe be more precise in what those numbers look like.
So here's a list of a few of the applications that we've specifically received in the various areas. Lots of residential type, condo or multifamily and single family, lots of that going on around the county. Most notably here at the top of the list, 179 multifamily units here behind Safeway in Leavenworth, in the Leavenworth area. So as you know, we're working on and working towards a new substation for additional substation capacity. There's been minor upgrades that have been going on with line extensions on the distribution line side. We're looking forward to that additional substation up there. So we'll have essentially three substations feeding sort of that greater Leavenworth area. We see some things here in Cashmere down at the bottom of the list is that 3.4 megawatts of Cashmere mill there that I was talking about as an application for pending design. So that's above and beyond the trust company, too. So
really?
We're working through that application. Yeah, so quite a bit of load continues to get added into Cashmere. What we're doing in Cashmere, there's an existing substation. We've been in discussions with the members of the city council and the mayor before, so we'll have to reconvene with new staff and new mayor, some of the discussions, but the existing substation that's there that is the a lower voltage that we're currently operating portions of the town as we're rebuilding the town and changing the voltage there, that space will become available potentially for use. So we've had some discussions with them about repurposing that substation for a new standard substation so we can have some additional capacity in the area. The new substation, the Cashmere substation that was Jarvis that was rebuilt, is almost fully utilized, especially after these requests. So,
and that one's close to the mill, too.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Not that that
be a good location. Well, that's all part of the siting process, right? Close to the load, close to the transmission, and available property. So then some other things in Chelan, as you know, on the North Shore of Chelan, we're also looking in other places in Chelan for future substation locations. So any questions on some of these actual applications that have come in? And
I would just conclude on this slide that because the Chelan PUD has the moratorium on cryptocurrency mining applications, that moratorium has allowed our staff to be very responsive these new applications that have come in and take away the ambiguity about do we have enough load to serve this organic growth. So it's been useful from that perspective. Mm-hmm. I know it's not sustainable forever, but it's certainly been useful for us to be able to respond to these customer requests more efficiently.
Chad, the 179 multi-family housing units behind Safeway, how are we doing with our time frame of the new substation? Does the new substation get built at the same time, or will we be able to handle that construction and then bring the substation on later? Or
I believe so. So the timing of some of these units, there's some capacity up there in the existing substation, so we should be able to get those things timed up. What we want to make sure that we're doing, even though we can sustain some short periods of overloads, and that just has an impact on the overall life expectancy of the equipment, right? So we want to make sure we have a plan in place that we're building capacity so that we're not sustaining those overloads, mm-hmm. that we're building additional capacity. So if they're off a little bit, that would be okay. We would just be taking on additional risk in terms of loading that equipment up and accelerating in its loss of life. But we want to make sure we have a plan in place. There's a lot of things in motion, obviously, right? The timing of all of these electrical demands coming online, the the construction, and then the permitting of the substation, the construction, the design, and permitting of the substation. There's a lot of moving parts in there, but ideally we would get those timed up to be the same time. If it does not happen, it's not a deal breaker either way, but we want to make sure that we have the infrastructure plans in place and we're moving forward with them.
You know, an interesting observation on what Commissioner McKenna was asking about is you add up all of those residential units and there's like 350 or thereabouts, and it's 1.5 megawatts, you know, which is really, in terms of a substation, not a huge item, but you go to that one item at the mill site and it's 3.5 megawatts and your eyeballs start to pop out a little bit.
Yeah, you start to get a picture of why we're concerned about
crypto
and mix, right? The cryptocurrency within the residential sector could really have a big difference. And when we hadn't planned on any of that occurring, it sort of turns our plans upside down.
Yeah. Chad, and maybe Andy, you can answer this. As I look at all this development coming online and knowing that we've had struggles finding locations for substations, have we gotten to the point where we're working with the municipalities to have them designate by the developer locations for assets that we need in a particular area to meet load growth?
Yeah, I think we could both weigh in on that. We're seeing some positive signs in that direction where, number one, the municipalities and the county are recognizing the need for those larger infrastructures, substations and transmission lines. And we piloted that discussion in the INIAT area, and we had what we think was a very successful collaborative discussion about siting infrastructure. We had the opportunity to go out with some of their staff and actually kick the dirt and look at different locations, and Chad was able to share why we would need a substation here or there. At the end of the day, we think that the majority of the INIAT community leaders there and the PUD have aligned on where the best locations are for some of that, and we're starting to take action on those today. I think we want to, and we're starting that discussion in Chelan. We've already started that in Leavenworth. We've already started that in INIAT and Cashmere. So all the municipalities are coming around on that for sure.
So I guess the second piece of that then is, are they seeing a clear connection between requiring a developer to provide land if they come as part of the permitting process?
Yeah, we haven't reached agreement on what the conditional use permitting process looks like from a developer standpoint. I think there's a recognition there that we need to be having a lot of discussions with the PUD prior to approving a large development, whether it's a residential development or not. And Chad and I have shared lots of ideas about how we think we can get them to the table prior to. But certainly a recognition that there's opportunities when land is rezoned and redeveloped that some of that should be set aside for utility infrastructure. I think there's a common understanding there. So we haven't carved out exactly what that process looks like.
Yeah, that's great. Even having those discussions, mm-hmm. which in the past maybe were a little bit more difficult to even have,
right.
And the fact that you're developing that relationship, that's great. Good work.
Anything to add on that?
No, we're trying to carry that out. How specifically that gets put in place, we're not quite sure.
Yeah,
I think it starts with them identifying where these locations might need to be within their comprehensive plan, because it's their comprehensive plan that they check in on when an application comes in. So I think that's the first place to start.
Yeah,
but then ultimately to get to the spot where you're talking about would be ideal. I think Andy and I share your vision there.
Yeah. No, that's great.
Definitely.
I think one of the comments that came out, I mean, quote from the municipalities during that June 20th planning meeting was, we just always have assumed the PUD could provide service. And, you know, that we made it very clear that that's changing now. The addition of not keeping up with building substations as needed, and combined with the cryptocurrency applicants, you know, we've got ourselves dug in a hole a little bit. And so the assumption that we're going to just be able to serve is not there anymore. We need to be having more proactive discussions about that very early.
The fact that you guys are having these discussions is fabulous. Great job.
I think we'll also take that as an action item for future report back to the board that there is specific commission interest in this item so that you can communicate that in your conversations with folks, and we'll include it in our list of action items coming out of this meeting.
Good. Thank you.
Great. That's a good segue into our last slide here. Just starting from the bottom, of course, looking forward, you know, we want to be responsive to those customers, those 360 residential development. We want to be very responsive to them and timely to them. They're working on solving a housing crisis here in the Valley, and we want to be responsive to them. So that's a primary focus. Next one up from the bottom is just focusing on identifying those agency preferences on the cryptocurrency planning and zoning. Of course, we can influence that in a large way, but they recognize it's their responsibility to build that zoning planning into their comprehensive plans, and they're working on that as we speak. The third bullet up from the bottom, they'll organize a multi-council commission study session. It was requested by that group that the councils and the commissions come together under one roof and have an in-depth discussion about zoning, planning, the impacts of the electric grid. I told them I'd bring that back to you as a discussion topic and see if there was interest in that. If there was interest in that, I'm not sure formally how that works with a quorum, but if there was interest by you to meet with the county commissioners as well as the municipal city councils under one roof and kind of have a roll your sleeves up discussion about this, we could certainly facilitate that.
Collaboration is a very good thing between agencies. I mean, we started the Tri-Commission not knowing where it would go, and it's to say that we've, quote, truly accomplished something, I'm not certain we can say that, other than we've become aware of the issues that each other faces, and I really believe in multi-agency collaboration. I think I'm a big fan.
So I think you've heard great. God. Okay. Be happy to participate.
Great. That sounds great. Okay. Any other questions? We'll wrap it up here.
Good presentation. Thanks.
All right.
Thanks for the support.
I like your picture too, by the way.
Sure. I'd like to say they were Commissioner Smith's, but I'm not sure.
I love this time of year just for that reason. Yeah.
We'll be coming back to the cryptocurrency issue a little bit later, but first of all, we want to talk about Two Dam Independence Project update.
I'm not sure.
Teresa. Good morning, commissioners. I'm Ryan Roy, analyst in energy planning and training.
And Chris McDarmond, system operations manager.
So today we're going to do a two-part presentation. The first part I'll be covering, which is an update on the Two Dam Independence Project. You may more affectionately know this as our preparation for the expiration of the Mid-Columbia Hourly Coordination Agreement. So it's the work underway to operate our projects absent central coordination. So we'll do a review of the project scope, schedule, and status. We're going to look at a staffing analysis and recommendation, and then we'll cover an overview of our requested actions. So June 2019, coordination with Grant County PUD, affectionately known as Central, will be ending. So at this point, we have to be prepared to operate our projects absent central coordination, make sure we can serve our participants' request for generation, and also account for their energy contractually on an after-the-fact basis. So we'll be assuming the functions that Central Management was performing for Rocky Reach and Rock Island. In support of that project, we're putting in some technology to help that happen. The first is a sub-hourly river forecasting model. We'll be using a tool called CADS West from Riverware. We'll be implementing a project and unit dispatch solution, Hatch Vista RT, and then implementing an improved energy accounting system to account for our participants' use of their energy and pond after the fact. So the design work is underway. We have contracts in place with all of the vendors. We have several deliverables from some of them already. From a technology perspective, we're very much on track to meet that cutover date. We have a executed project execution plan. It's accepted by the project stakeholders and sponsors. And we're currently on schedule for a May 29th, 2019 cutover. The cutover requires that we, you know, work in close coordination with Grant PUD and our participants. This is not a project where we can sort of flip the switch and go on our way. We're sort of tightly coupled with our neighbors and our participants. And so a big part of that May 29th date is making sure that we're all on the same page in terms of a cutover. So at a high level, so we have a project budget that's about $3 million. The commission has seen several service agreements related to this project. So the forecast and modeling tool, Riverware, that's 18-142-40. An energy accounting system, that's web accounting by OATI. You've seen presentations from our control systems group in the past about the energy management system upgrade. So that was not a requirement of this project, but they will be able to use functionality provided by that system to help. And also consulting services. We're using Superior as our project management, so you've seen a resolution for them. And then we also had two agreements that were executed within delegated authority. So our real-time plant unit dispatch, which is Hatch Vista RT, and then some technical programming and support services. So that's sort of the extent of the service agreements we have related to this. We spent a fair amount of time on design work, technical implementation. The second portion of this is going to be a discussion about what we think we may need in terms of staffing.
So we started the staffing evaluation in March of this year with a core group of four members, Chad Bowman, Dan Garrison, Janet Jaspers, and myself. And then we added, as part of the analysis team, the system operations trainer, human resources, labor relations, members of the technical team for the TDIP, as well as Superior Consulting and QTS. We evaluated both internal and external options using the decision evaluation criteria. QTS had previously assisted us with a job task analysis for our NERC-required PER5 job task analysis, and they'd also helped with Grant County PUDs. They helped us evaluate what Grant is doing now for Central, and they helped us perform an extensive job task analysis for what we will be doing when we separate from Grant County after hourly coordination ends. We then estimated how much time each task would take during the course of a day, week, month, year, to come up with an estimate for the impact on staffing, and we determined from that analysis that at least initially we wouldn't be able to meet the requirements of a successful cutover. Our findings were then presented to the senior management team and received preliminary approval during May and June. The recommended solution was to staff a third 24/7 system operator desk, and we're able to cover all hours of the year with five FTEs. We'll accomplish that by reassigning one current Monday through Friday day shift system operator and four new hires. As we gain experience and optimize the automation post-cutover, an analysis may demonstrate that we may reduce staff, which we will accomplish utilizing three employees through attrition. Those employees are eligible for full retirement without penalty in the next 2 years. And this would require no budget revision for 2018, but would be included in future budget forecasts. This slide highlights why this proposal is recommended using the decision evaluation criteria. The impact to customer owners is approximately $765,000 per year in labor costs, which is less than what outsourcing would cost. It can be implemented by the cutover date, which is the hourly coordination end of the agreement. It allows for succession planning and risk mitigation. It supports cybersecurity and participant confidentiality. Commitment to district values. It also best allows us to meet the operational requirements established by the senior management team in July of last year. So the next steps for staffing would be to approve a staffing resolution, complete labor negotiations, review candidates, perform interviews and extend offers, get those new employees on site and complete their qualification and certification process, as well as train all system operators on their new responsibilities. You may choose to take more time to review the staffing recommendation, which is fine, but I also know that you were already very familiar with this project and were probably wondering how we were going to meet the challenge of cutting over to independent operations successfully. Mm-hmm. So if you're ready to act today, due to timelines, we would like this to be done by the end of the month, but if you are ready to act today, we've prepared a memo and a resolution authorizing this direction. Are there any questions?
I want to add one thing real quick. So under our policies, it's not a requirement of the board to pass a resolution to increase staffing. That's within the authority of the general manager. It's just been my sense, since I've been here actually, that we go through staffing levels and the board adopts a budget, and in there are staffing levels, and staffing can be a sensitive issue. So I want to be absolutely sure the board understands when we're changing staffing levels, and the best way to do that, I think, is through formal resolution of some kind. So we are bringing this forward ultimately as a formal resolution. Again, planning that it would be adopted or addressed at the next board meeting. You have the option to do so today if you want to, as you always do.
I personally would like to have Dennis be back by that time.
Yeah, I think it'd be better to do it at the next meeting. But I think it was clearly identified. We have known this is coming. I mean, you guys have been very good at creating the awareness in front of the issue. Knew it was going to be there.
We have a sort of a mismatch between staffing and workload in a sort of a bubble period, and we've been trying to come up with creative ways to do that, looking at various alternatives. So pairing this with the possible succession planning attrition seemed like a reasonable approach.
Yeah, it does.
We'd like to also say that you can't see the substantial body of work behind this, but this team has put together a very detailed listing of the hours of work that are required in order to be able to get this done, as we were testing what's the right amount of staffing that's necessary in order to be able to proceed. So it's we've really questioned how much do we need to do. And I think at this point there's a risk issue associated with going to independent operations that causes us to think we don't want to get that one wrong and have a problem with the operation of the projects. But as this group has identified, there's going to be an opportunity, and in fact explicitly we're going to be going through and evaluating, once we get a chance to see how it works, do we really need this level of staffing?
You know, there's also another good reminder in your presentation that we don't think about maybe as much as we could, and to staff a full-time position 24 hours a day, 7 days a week requires 5 people. And most average people just don't even think about
that. Don't understand that.
That's right.
Yeah. When you have a 24/7 position.
Right. And we'd hate to turn the electricity off on the weekend.
So I do have a question.
Sure.
As well, and I didn't see this in your presentation, and perhaps the answer would better come from Greg, but have our trading partners been notified of these changes, and how would this, and again maybe Greg at some point we do a presentation, how would that this change our trading, especially in the short trading time frames?
So I'll address that in a couple of ways. So the first, Douglas was a participant in coordination, and they left coordination, July of last year. So in terms of our participants particularly and other Mid-C participants, they've known that this project is coming. So some of them have been through the process one time with Douglas. We have participants like Puget who also have a share in the Wells project. So from that perspective, they know this is a project that has been on the work plan, for about a year and a half or two. I think they have a reasonable understanding of what it's going to take. We haven't personally started reaching out to our participants, you know, specifically related to the systems and changing business processes that we have put in place, but there's been a significant outreach effort in terms of what this means, you know, with our relation with them, what it means for how they use the projects, how we intend to continue to try to meet their needs. So that outreach has happened. This won't be a surprise to them. We've gone through some analysis, sort of looking at the economic impact. I think we could talk a little bit about that in a different presentation, but we've tried to understand, quantify what it's going to mean from, you know, a trading perspective, from our partner, you know, partnerships with people like Puget and Avista and Douglas, Morgan Stanley, or other participants. So that outreach has been happening. And if it's something that you're interested in, sort of in a more in-depth look at how we've been doing that, particularly from maybe a financial impact, I think we could go through that exercise.
At some point, it might be interesting to get a vague idea of any impact, particularly if it's a negative impact, to trading revenues from energy sales as a result of this change in hourly coordination.
I think we can take that as an action item and put together something to help you understand the potential impacts.
Thank you. Anything else? Thank you.
Very good.
Thank you. Thank you.
Somebody's mentioned something about that picture.
It's a beautiful picture.
The house is right down there.
That's why we had it on file, yeah, Commissioner.
That one's on my wall.
So I'd like to interrupt our regularly scheduled agenda for just a moment, because we do have a member of the public here provide public comment on the NTIAT agreement. The mayor is here, and so we'd like to invite him up to join us at the table and just offer any comments that he would like to make.
Welcome.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for the opportunity. I was remiss in getting here a little earlier trying to get through your security system, but I appreciate the security and the time it takes to do that. Understand you did go through and review some of the opportunities we had as far as trying to finish up some of our marina piece. It's been almost 7 years in the making, so your permitting team has really been instrumental in trying to help finalize that. I've only been on board with the city for 3 months and had not the slightest bit of an idea of how complicated this process is going to be, just trying to get it finished up. So they've been really instrumental in helping finalize the last little bit of that. We're really anxious and looking forward to that opportunity and kind of getting NTIAT to have another new identity. It's been a long time in coming. And then, of course, with the new opportunities with the substation piece as well, I think it's going to be a real good chance to have us be able to look at a number of opportunities to site some commercial and retail and hope, and also some multifamily opportunities there. Hoping to be able to help the Valley with their difficulty with their housing and the, you know, the less than 1% vacancy rates that we have. So just the opportunity just to come and thank the PUD and your commissioners for your assistance in helping us do that. It's been a real key piece to keeping that moving forward.
Well, good. Glad to help. I think, Randy, you said it best earlier.
Well, we want to thank the city of NTIAT for giving their all 50 years ago, too.
Yeah. I think that's we've had a few false starts. There's been a little bit of a sense of apathy, if you will. I've seen that people are all of a sudden, I've got people coming in now, and what's going on? We hear new things, and they're not going, we've heard that before. They're actually starting to get excited. So looking forward to that opportunity coming up here soon.
Well, that's great. Well,
do you have any questions for me or any thoughts?
You know, this may or may not be the right venue, but I'm curious about you. We've never met before.
Yes. While I was on the Planning Commission for a couple of years, while I was still, I spent about 30 years in the travel industry as a commercial pilot. And so I settled here permanently about 9 years ago and was making a commute for about 6 of those years to L.A. Haven't missed that. fluid and Snoqualmie can be a challenge in wintertime. I don't think I have to tell anybody that.
Yeah.
And then I retired a couple of years ago, and I was on the council for 2 years. And then when Mayor Bradenburg fell ill and had to have a heart valve replacement, I was asked to step in. So I've been really thankful, and it's been really rewarding to try to serve. And didn't quite know what I was getting myself into. My wife has been very patient, so, and I appreciate all the support that the rest of you folks have given me as well. So I hope I can continue to bring new ideas forward for you.
Well, welcome.
Yeah, right. Welcome. Yeah.
Thank you very much for your support.
And we hope that you'll become an active player. And we have an entity called the Tri-Commission, and we always invite the mayors. And it's become a very good sharing of what's going on and potentially some cooperation, collaboration mm-hmm. on a countywide basis.
Yeah, no, I saw that for the first time just recently, and that was but was a little, you know, the proverbial drinking from the fire hose. I'm just trying to get caught up with all the acronyms. You know?
Yeah.
That takes a while.
I appreciate that.
So. Yeah.
Great.
Thank you yeah. for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for sharing today. Appreciate it.
Okay, next up, we wanted to come back to the cryptocurrency issue. We have been given a lot of thought to, as we described in the public meeting that was held earlier, defining a new rate classification for cryptocurrency. A lot of work by the team and a lot of work by the General Counsel's Office. Lindsay Mons will present for us today.
Good morning, Commissioners.
Morning.
Good morning.
Lindsay Mons, Business Manager in Customer Utilities. So as Steve mentioned, we've been talking about the cryptocurrency rate class as part of the cryptocurrency moratorium that's currently in place. And one thing that we need to do through a moratorium and developing solutions for that is to check in along the way with you. We don't want to get too far down the road with a particular idea and then come to you and change course. So this is a check-in today. There's no decisions to be made on your behalf or on your part. But if you do have opinions or anything for us, we'd gladly take those back to the team as we continue this effort. So in today's discussion, we're going to talk a little bit about the challenges that we're having with our existing Schedule 35 definition, which, if you remember, was the definition we put in place for high-density loads as our initial effort for understanding kind of what the high-density impact is to our system. We'll talk a little bit about characteristics specific to cryptocurrency and those similar loads, and then the draft definition for the new class. So Schedule 35, which was put in place in January, or went effective January 1st, 2017, addressed server farms and similar technological operations. And it, within this definition is the energy use intensity, or EUI. And in that, it's the 250 kilowatt hours per square foot per year for operating square footage is how we calculate that EUI. And that's been a challenge, especially in working with small cryptocurrency operations, because they typically go in someone's basement or in a back room or a spare closet because they are so small. And those customers read the rate schedule and they interpret the EUI to mean the square footage of their entire house. Where we've defined it differently, we've defined it to be the operating square footage of the energy consuming activity. So it would be that closet square footage. And that's been really difficult to explain, difficult for customers to understand. We have customers reading the schedule and assuming that they that the schedule doesn't apply to them. And so then they're operating outside of our regulation, which would require them to apply for service and be within the correct rate schedule. So that was one of the initial drivers for developing another rate class. Also, another driver is really the specific impact that cryptocurrency is having to our system. So this is my non-engineering study of cryptocurrency. So if we just look at the average U.S. home, nationwide uses about 1,000 kilowatt hours per month. Our energy use in this area is a little higher because of the electric heat without a gas resource, so other areas where heating is gas, energy use is a little less. But so just in general, in the average U.S. home is approximately equivalent to the energy use of one ASIC machine.
Wow.
So, you know, in our area, maybe it's a machine and a half, but I don't know that you could really operate a machine and a half. And as soon as you hit two, you're well over a single home. So this makes a huge difference to us on the infrastructure side of things and serving residential areas where we plan for a load that looks like a single home. And now as soon as you start adding machines in a home, you've got, you know, 3, 4, 5, 48 homes stacked on top of each other in one single service point.
You know, I just want to clarify one thing because I found this a little bit confusing once before. It might be for you as well. Recall that in our presentation at the public meeting, we described an ASIC machine being equivalent to a clothes dryer. So that's the peak demand. You don't run your clothes dryer 24/7. An ASIC machine runs 24/7. So you have a capacity usage, peak demand, and you have an energy usage. This is the energy usage comparison.
So when we're looking at the impact that specific loads have to our system, this list of items here, of those impacting loads, things like high load factor, the abnormal alterations to electrical services that are required to maintain the safety, the small units that are portable and distributable, all of these things are, you know, generally, well, they're all impacts to our system. And the one common element of them all is that they're all, every time we see these in our service territory so far, it's been with cryptocurrency. So that is how we drew the line of, you know, cryptocurrency or blockchain, that sort of application. All of those type of services are having this type of impact. So in defining a cryptocurrency rate load or similar, these are the characteristics that we would look at to consider a similar load. When we're evaluating, because we do recognize that things are going to progress. Technology changes and progresses over time, even just in the 2 years since we were talking about this the last time. We know a lot more now. In 2 years from now, it'll look a whole lot different. So based on these characteristics, we've proposed a rate class definition that we hope will address the various risks that, and challenges that we see with these type of loads. Things like cost recovery, stranded assets, premature aging, the safety reliability that we've talked extensively about before, future planning, both on the infrastructure side of things, transmission distribution, and then as well as on the energy resource planning. So when new loads come into our area that we weren't planning for, there's a risk that they kind of become our predominant use of energy that we weren't planning for. So especially at the sizes that we see requested. And we're also seeing significant impact to other district projects within the performance plan that we had approved previously in the year. So based on all of those elements, we've defined a new rate class, cryptocurrency and blockchain processing and similar loads. So it would apply to any amount of computing or data processing associated with those types of activities, being cryptocurrency mining, Bitcoin, blockchain, any proof of work or other loads. That are, in our determination, similar and based on all those characteristics that were on the slide previous. So I won't reread them all here, but the high energy use density, high load factor, those types of things. So from here, the next step staff would take would be to utilize this definition, continuing development of that rate class, so looking at the cost associated and how that aligns in our cost of service and things with this definition. As mentioned, you know, this is a change from Schedule 35. We do intend to keep Schedule 35 in place as it is. This would be an additional rate schedule, and in this rate schedule, we would not reference the EUI. And we would define those similar load characteristics. So that's our plan at this point, unless the board has thoughts or opinions otherwise. That's our path forward. We'd have a next board update in July, the next meeting in July, talk about this and some other things that we're working on. And then the next moratorium hearing is coming up soon in August.
It is.
I just want to take a moment and just say, I think this is a really important step that helped me at least to clarify my own thinking about how we're going to address different types of new loads. So what we were seeing was a problem with, we had new industries that were interested in coming to Chelan County and making large investments in facilities and that suggested they were going to make a long-term commitment to being here, but were high energy users. And so they were hitting the high density load definition. But they were different from what we see with cryptocurrency miners, which create the transient risk. And so by separating these, we, it allows us to be able to approach what we really see as two different types of loads that are coming at us. Ones that are high energy users, and so they have consequences for the rest of the district customer owners, but some of which you have a fairly high level of confidence that you're going to get cost recovery over time for investments that you make, and others of which that you don't have that confidence.
I think that's the part that helped me a lot. So anyway, I just share that thought.
I think it's a good differentiation. Mm-hmm. Necessary.
Yeah, I agree.
So let me just say from here, I want to emphasize that we really are have been working hard to try to identify proposed pricing regimes, rates that would apply to these different categories of load. And we're hopeful that we will be able to bring you something at the next meeting so that there would be something in public in advance of the August 6th meeting. Can't absolutely promise that yet, because we're pretty close, mm-hmm. and think that we may be able to get that work completed enough that we could put a proposal on the table.
Okay.
Great. So any other questions? Otherwise, thank you.
Thank you, Lindsay. Appreciate it. The presentation.
And actually, Steve, I appreciate not having those rates in front of me right now, because I think philosophically I need to have the rationale to address that concern regardless of what the rates are. I need that rationale that we can present to people and say, so now try to argue this, regardless of the rate, argue that philosophical belief. And I think that's what you've done here, and I think that's really important.
Thanks. Commissioners, we're at a point in the agenda where I might suggest a way to proceed here. We're a little bit ahead of schedule. There is an opportunity here with the time. I was guessing that our executive session would take somewhere around 45 minutes to an hour. We've got about 45 minutes before lunch. Might suggest that we just move to executive session and see if we can conclude that within the time before noon.
Sure. Okay. We're good. So we have a need for an executive session. And We have that need to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risks as authorized by RCW. To consider the selection of a site or the acquisition of real estate by lease or purchase when public knowledge regarding such consideration would cause a likelihood of increased price as authorized by RCW. And to consider the minimum price at which real estate will be offered for sale or lease when public knowledge regarding such considerations would cause the likelihood of decreased price as authorized by RCW.
And I would suggest for 45
For 45 minutes? Good. We need a break at all? Any quick break?
Not here.
We're coming out of executive session. It is July 9, 2018. No decisions were made. No votes were taken. Any additional business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we will stand adjourned.
Yep. Recess and reconvene.
Recess and reconvene. Thank you. We'll reconvene at 1 o'clock. Thank you.
All
right. Good afternoon and welcome to the July 9th, 2018 business session of the Chelan County PUD. I'd like to remind everyone, please silence your cell phones or any other electronic devices that you may have. I'd like to welcome our visitors today. We're a great place. We place great value
on public input at our meetings, and since these meetings are recorded, if you wish to address any item on the agenda, we ask that you come to the microphone, speak clearly, state your name and address for the record. This afternoon, we have a quorum of three. Is Ann on the phone?
I don't know. I just heard Commissioner McKenna.
Ann, are you on the phone?
Yes, I am.
There's four of us.
Thank you. We have a quorum with four commissioners attending. Commissioner Congdon and McKenna are on the phone. Commissioner Bolt's not with us this afternoon. All customary staff members are here today. The general manager, Steve Wright, the general counsel, Eric Walquist, and sitting in as clerk of the board, Teresa Boucher. Thank you for being here today, Teresa.
Thank you.
Before we go on any further, I'd like to, well, it's my honor to forward a proclamation that was signed by Governor Inslee declaring tomorrow, July 10th, as Line Worker Appreciation Day. And I'd like to read the proclamation as the governor has presented it. The state of Washington celebrates and recognizes electrical line workers and wishes to honor those individuals for their exemplary service. And the line working profession requires exceptional skill, knowledge, passion, and dedication. Line workers are often first responders during the weather emergencies and other catastrophic events, working to repair broken and damaged electrical lines for other emergency responders. Line workers also play a critical role in our communities by maintaining and building electrical infrastructure. Line workers expose themselves to the hazards of working with high voltage electricity. I, the Governor, Jay Inslee, of the State of Washington, do hereby proclaim July 10, 2018, as Line Worker Appreciation Day in Washington State, and I encourage all people in our state to join me in this special observance. So I'd like to invite, we have some representatives here from our line workers, we'd like to invite line workers to please to come up, Tim. And I'd like to also give you a copy of this proclamation. And I would encourage you to there's a couple of copies.
Okay. I guess maybe a couple things. Gary, Commissioner Arsenal, you covered a lot of the things that we do. All three of us are journeyman linemen as well, although we're in supervisory roles now. Top-notch linemen. These two have been foremen here at the district too for some years, so very experienced in it. Just like to touch on a couple things. One of the things that wasn't mentioned there that has become more and more evident is we are face-to-face with customers day in and day out. And so the lineman trade has changed to a much more personal relationship with the customers, and I think the crews here do a fantastic job. We've got some foremen out there that could be face-to-face with customers day in and day out, and they would take care of a number of different issues. Another thing that has changed a lot here is our careers get a lot longer as journeyman linemen now. So that's where the thanks comes in to you commissioners for improving the budgets that we need to get our tools that we need. The last 4 or 5 years, we have focused heavily on the tools that save our wrists, elbows, shoulders, a number of those things that create time loss days and things for us. And so I'll end it on that we are at this point in time very fortunate. We're moving into our fifth full year of without a lost time accident or injury. And that's actually unheard of in the line industry when you're running as many crews as we are in the work that we do. So the linemen here do a fantastic job. They get a lot of work done. They're professionals. And thank you for approving those budgets that we need to keep them coming in safe every night.
Hi, guys. It's great to be recognized and appreciated. It always is anytime you do that. And those guys that we have, they just do a fabulous job. So I would just like to make it short and sweet. And anytime you see them, just a nice honk and a friendly wave, and that'll go a lot farther than one person might think. Thanks.
Again, thank you for this recognition for the linemen. These guys do put their lives on the line all the time and in harm's way, day and night. And we're forced to go out in the extreme emergencies. When other people are running out, we're going in. So with that, we do appreciate this, and all of us, including our entire group, are proud to be journeyman linemen.
I'd like to just share a quick story with you. Just yesterday, and this has happened multiple times, but the most recently yesterday, I'm trying to sell a car. And, you know, you get all these calls. A guy calls and he asked this question. He's like, well, I want to meet you tomorrow, which is today. And I said, well, I'm kind of busy tomorrow. I can't do it. Maybe after 5:30. He's like, oh, yeah, what do you do? Because I had told him, retired. It's like you're retired, but you're busy. So I told him that I'm here at the PUD, and he's like, oh, I got a story to tell you. He said, I've had some work done recently, and it involved a line truck. And those guys were great. I just want to tell you how proud I am. This is somebody who grew up in Chelan County. How proud I am to have the Chelan County PUD and the ambassadors that you have as linemen that come out into the community, and they bend over backwards for you. So people see it, and you really are our ambassadors. So we appreciate the work you do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, really appreciate it.
Well, since you were willing to share a story, I'd like to share a story too. And I look around the room, I think the only person in the room that probably really knows the story is Kirk, because it goes back several years. When I was in my first few years as a commissioner, I said, you know, I'd really like to spend, you know, some time out with a line crew. And I don't know if it was you or Jeff that set it up, or both of you together, but I think they plotted and waited for the weather to really be right. And it was the first week of April. The line crew, the foreman was Willie Neerman, and they were pulling a new ground on transmission from Rocky Reach up over the hill on the Douglas County side, and it was cold. It was miserable. And I spent the better part of a day out there with that crew, going up and down the switchbacks and on the four-wheelers and freezing my hind end off. And before that, I'd had an intellectual appreciation for what you guys go through. And I know that in the wintertime, it's even tougher than that. It did snow on us that day, by the way. And that is forever ingrained in my mind, what you guys do to get the job done. And I just want to say, I really appreciate what you do. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You remember that, Kirk? Yeah, you and Jeff drove to Chelan that day for some.
Thank you.
Yeah. Might just take one moment and say that these guys are definitely selfless, but they shouldn't go not identified. So for purpose of the recording, that was Tim Pettit, Dan Mosier, and Curtie Murdoch who are here, and we appreciate your being here to represent all of the folks who work on the line crew. So thank you so much.
And please share the message. I know you will, but
you will.
Thank you.
Okay. So, commissioners, we have a consent agenda in front of us.
I would move approval of the consent agenda.
Do I hear a second?
Second.
It has been moved and seconded. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed signify by saying no. The motion is carried. We're now down to the regular agenda. Steve, would you like to talk about that?
Sure. Agenda 9, a resolution authorizing execution of the Hydropower Research Institute membership bridging agreement and delegating the authority to the general manager to appoint the district's representatives on the Institute's board of directors. Kirk Hudson will present.
Good afternoon. Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. Pleased to be here today in front of you. This is an exciting opportunity and exciting time for the district as well as hydropower research for the entire industry. You might recall in March 19th and April 16th, the board approved $500,000 of public power benefit funds going towards the facilitation and the formation of a hydropower research institute. Well, we're here today to say we're ready to go do that. And that has to do with the resolution that you have in front of you. Before we get there, I'd like to just give you an update on the concept of the Institute and where we're at with it. You might recall that the real value of the Hydropower Research Institute is the aggregation of operational data from multiple hydropower owners. There's three categories of participants that we would envision being involved in the Hydropower Research Institute, what we call the members and contributors. These are hydropower owners. Members are ones that provide operational data and also provide significant funding to the Institute for formation and operation. Contributors are those that are also hydropower owners, but they're providing an annual fee for the Institute to be part of it. And then we have this subscriber classification, which is a whole group of different sectors of the industry that are interested in getting access to the data but don't have any data to provide because they're not hydropower owners. Some of the subscribers we've been talking to are manufacturers of equipment, national laboratories who are doing all kinds of research in the hydropower industry. They're having difficulty getting their hands on the data. And then we've certainly talked to colleges and universities that would love nothing more than to have access to a large data set that they can have their students and graduate researchers actually work on the data. Again, it goes back to the value being the data itself. The offerings for the Institute include aggregated data set, a base platform with base analytic capabilities for the data, and then data visualization tools that would come with the data itself. I think one of the things that we've really prided ourselves in and this concept and formation of it is the flexibility that hydropower owners are pretty much all over the map in terms of how far they've gone on the journey of digital transformation. For those that are just starting, this will provide them the basics for getting involved. For those that are very sophisticated and have already spent millions and millions of dollars, they'll have the capability to use what they've already developed if they would like to, or they can go out and use open source software. So there's a lot of flexibility in terms of how each entity involved in this can actually get access to the data and the software programs that they can use to analyze the data. I'd also like to add that there, you might recall in March, there was a significant display of community interest amongst agriculture industry, healthcare industry, and technology industry as well. We had a number of participants from cities and other companies that were here that also talked about how interested they are in this and the collaboration across the different industries locally in terms of they're all doing the same thing in terms of they'd like to do the same thing in terms of using data from their industries and then collaborate across the industries. We've already learned a tremendous amount from the agriculture industry in terms of what they're doing technology-wise and planning to use some of the things that they've deployed right here in the hydropower industry. So there's tremendous opportunity there as well as the education interest at the community college level. Next steps planned include filing the formation documents, getting a board of directors up and running, and bringing Southern Company on board as the other initial founding member, and then developing agreements with a legal firm, a CPA firm, bank, and an operations contractor. The resolution you have in front of you actually has three elements to it. The first one is delegating the authority to the general manager to execute what's called a bridging agreement. And the purpose of the bridging agreement is, as the board has approved the $500,000 for formation, it allows the Institute to spend up to $75,000 on the fees associated with filing those forming documents, as well as anything else, putting any agreements in place that are necessary, including a legal firm. So it makes it very clear that $75,000 is part of the $500,000 and the conditions with which that can be spent. The other piece of the resolution is delegating the authority of the general manager to appoint district representatives to be on the board of directors for the Institute. And the third piece is delegating the authority to the district employees that are identified as the representatives on the Institute to sign the formation documents, including the Articles of Incorporation. All this is, with this resolution, it certainly paves the way for those activities to happen right away and will happen in short order. There's been a lot of preparatory work done to get those documents ready to go. And then all in the effort of, by the end of the year, actually having an aggregated data set available between at least Chelan PUD, Southern Company, and Army Corps of Engineers operational data. With that, I'm available for any questions you might have.
Ultimately, is the Army Corps going to be able to be a member by virtue of the type of entity they are?
So that's the distinction between the member and the contributor. It's a very good question. They could not be a member. What they could do is be a contributor, and that's how they would participate in an annual contribution with the data as well as the costs associated with it. But yeah, as a federal agency, they can't be a member in terms of the real piece is the contribution financially up front for the member, as well as the ability to direct where the Institute goes and participate on a board of directors, and they could not do that.
Can't do either of those. Okay.
Yeah.
Kirk, the size of the data that you're collecting, Southern Company is huge, Army Corps of Engineers is gigantic. So just the data from those two sources represents, is there a way to quantify it, percentage of data available?
Yeah, so Army Corps of Engineers in itself is about 25% of, when you talk percentage-wise, we're talking about capacity, how many megawatts in the hydro industry. They represent about 25 by themselves. So between us and Southern Company and the Army Corps of Engineers, we're in the 30% range of all hydropower, just with those three entities.
Wow.
Yeah. So we've been talking to a number of other agencies and utilities, and there's it would not be far-fetched to realistically be in the 40-50% pretty quick.
Wow.
Just with the people we've been talking to.
Yeah, with people like Avista and Idaho Power.
Yep, we've been talking to both of them. We've been talking to a number of utilities in the Northwest and the Northeast, and actually in Canada and in other countries as well. So just to give you a feel for, we have three plants and 31 units. That's the data we're contributing. Southern Company has 32 plants with 102 units. Army Corps of Engineers has 75 plants, 356 units. So real value is the size of the data, where you can really leverage that data to do all kinds of things with it.
It really gets exciting when you start talking international.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's great.
Well, thank you.
So,
did we have...
I'm the only commissioner in the room other than Gary, and he can't make a motion, can he?
Right, no.
But I would move that we approve Resolution 9 with excitement.
Do we have a second?
I'll have a second.
Okay, I think we've got
second and third.
Second and third in there, that's right. So the motion has been moved and seconded. Do we have any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
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 I think that's unanimous.
Mm-hmm.
So it's passed. Very good.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Good project.
I'm excited about that one.
Yeah. I can see the look on your face. You are excited about that
yes.
one.
Yeah.
Okay. Manager items.
I have one.
Sorry.
Well, while they're waiting, if I could propose the motion for item 11.
Why don't we move forward and do that?
I would. You're here? No. Oh, you're waiting. Okay. Okay. I would move to set a special meeting on July 30th, 2018, at 5:30 p.m. at Visconti's, 1737 North Wenatchee Avenue in Wenatchee, for the purpose of holding a Mid-Sea Commissioners and General Managers meeting.
So the motion has been proposed. Do we hear a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Do we have any discussion? No discussion. All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
So it's unanimous. Proposed. Passed. All right. Any other, while we're doing this, any other commission items while we're on that subject? Okay, well, I think we're ready.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. I'm Kimberly Craig, working in communications, and it's my great privilege to invite you to a really fun event on Sunday, July 22nd, at the Seattle Mariners. It is going to be Hydropower Appreciation Day. And there are many, many sponsors, of which Chelan PUD is one of those. And the goal is just to talk a little bit more for the folks in the Northwest about all the benefits of hydropower. No one knows that more than we do with our parks, with our environmental stewardship, with our affordable rates, and with clean, green, carbon-free hydropower. So as part of that, this has been an effort organized by FWE, the Foundation for Water and Energy Education. We, of course, partner with FWE on many programs. Just recently, the Hydropower STEM Career Academy that we hosted at Rocky Reach. This is another outreach to tell folks more about hydropower, how it works. So there's going to be an information booth on the concourse. Debbie Gallagher and I will be staffing along with folks from many other utilities, and the rest of the time we'll be up in Section 309 in the high bleachers of Wright Field, rooting on the Mariners. And it was also an opportunity for FWE to coordinate giving away free tickets for folks who submitted a hydropower haiku. And we are so lucky to have one of the winners, one of our very own Chelan PUD winner is Lisa Sanders, and she's going to share with you her winning hydropower haiku.
There were many winners. I wasn't the only winner.
But she was, Commissioner, she was the most excited winner.
I bet. I heard you up at Forest Ridge.
I was walking down the hall when she came running out going, I won!
I won, I won, I won! Hot damn, I won. Clearly. Yeah, it is hydro. So, my haiku is, roaring waters race, spinning turbines round and round, see the city lights.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
cool.
Good job.
Thanks.
So, all of the winning haikus are at FWEE.org. And also the information about the a program and how to be directed to tickets in our same area is both on FWE's website, FWEE.org, and also on our website under events for July 22nd.
Well, that's wonderful.
Hope to see you there.
How many FWE tickets can you get?
Oh,
that was good.
Well, Commissioner, as you know, there's no FWE lunch. So we are, of course, paying our fair share, but we at least will all be together in the same one if you go through the FWE portal.
$20 tickets.
Right. Cool. Yeah. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you. Good job, Lisa.
You mean do this now or wait?
Sure. I
think it's time. Congratulations, Lisa.
Thank you.
You have a hidden talent. That's impressive.
Well, at least you all knew me before I get famous. I've been been kidding my husband since I submitted this that I was going to win, just as a huge joke, because there was no way I was going to win. So when I told him I won, he actually thought I was kidding.
Yeah, take someone else.
That's right. Anyway, okay, so our next travel for commissioners.
Next week.
Is next week. We have Commissioners Arsenault, McKenna, and Smith traveling to Chehalis for WAPUTA meetings, with hotels checking in Wednesday and out Friday. Is Commissioner McKenna on the phone?
Yep.
Yes.
Commissioner McKenna, do you plan on attending?
Well, that's a really good question. I was going to, depending upon what answer you give me on what my cutoff is, I may or may not be able to attend.
Okay, I think we probably have a 24-hour deadline on the hotel, but I can double check.
All right. You wouldn't get back to me, then I can. We'll go from there.
Okay, thank you. And next, we have Commissioner Arsenault headed to APPA policymakers.
Yes, that is correct.
And I submitted your alternate personal travel form to Stacy last week, and she's gone today, so I'm sure she'll review it.
Okay, great.
Tomorrow.
Thank you.
Perfect. In September, we have WAPUTA meetings, the 12th through 14th. I have everyone besides Commissioner Congdon attending.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. And September 26th through 28th, Commissioners Congdon and Smith attending the WAPUTA workshop. Yes?
So far, yes. So far?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. October 18th, Commissioner Smith heading to Olympia for the Budget Committee meeting for WAPUTA. November, association meetings in Olympia rooms at the Doubletree with Commissioner Bowles at Town Place. And December's annual conference, I confirmed, is in Tulalip, but we don't know which location yet.
Okay.
So do we have any changes, anything I can add, anything I can help you with?
Commissioners, no?
Nope.
Okay.
Looks good.
That's it.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're done with the manager item, correct?
I am. Yes. Actually, I'm sorry. I did have one more. I just did want to report to you that the safety investigations from the Rock Island incident are underway. The internal investigation, the interviews have already begun, and Elle and I will be here not this week, but next week to begin their investigation. Okay.
Thank you. Follow up on delegation items?
There were none from the last meeting.
Okay. And delegation items?
I have two. One, to get back to you on the issue of on IDing substation sites when large developments are brought forward. That will not be brought forward at the next meeting. It will come up probably at the next quarterly report. We'll come back and talk about that. Okay. And then the request for some review on the revenue impact from independent operations, that likely will not be the next meeting as well. We'll figure out the time for that.
Okay. And any public for public comment? Any matters of general business? I guess that is it.
And we have finished executive session, so it really
executive
is it.
Session is over.
Okay. Wow.
All right. Incredible. Wow. Is this a record?
It's got to be close.
Check that out.
I don't know. Am I doing something wrong here?
You haven't You haven't missed anything yet.
Okay, well, I guess that's it. Unless there's any other comments from commissioners, that would conclude our meeting today. Steve, Ann, anything for the good of the order?
Nothing for me.
Okay. Well, then, we are adjourned.